United Kingdom includes Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and England. They're a little patchy if you get those terms confused. Great Britain is commonly used these days, and you should make be aware that these are very diverse cultures that are joined in a political union. So that's where the cities where I visited took place. I was there with the funding and the very gracious arrangements made by Professor Ian Buchan, who many of you here know, outstanding individual. My work was paid for by the UK, not by the US. That led to all kinds of excitement with getting work visas, which, if you're considering, I'm going to the UK on a work visa, I suggest you start now. You know, you plan to go there in several years. I traveled throughout the UK. You can see here that I went to all these cities. I did not go to Northern Ireland. I did not go to Wales. I talked to people from Wales. I was based in the University of Manchester, which is the city right there in what they call Northwest England, but actually it's about the center of the area. So, 2 months, those locations, I was a sponsor. The people that I interviewed, and as this scrolls by, you can see that I spoke with clinicians, professors, general practitioners, administrators, researchers, a journalist who wrote extensively on this in the British Medical Journal, got me interested in Michael Cross, GPs, a fair number of GPs, and officials in the National Health Service, and those who study the National Health Service. So I tried to get a cross-section of people who knew a little bit about IT and the National Health Service. And I did spend a few days taking a look at the rest of the country, and I only have an hour, so I'm showing you my travel log very, very quickly. But as you can see, it's a great country with, I think, a ill-deserved reputation for bad food. It's actually pretty good food. Claiming it's the healthiest diet. So I went there to answer these questions. The first question I had, I was interested in health information exchange, and I wondered how barriers to health information exchange have been addressed in the United Kingdom, perhaps somewhat differently than in our own country. What barriers still remain, and why are they still there? I wondered also if the UK had succeeded in bringing together the wide variety of technologies and companies to permit information exchange to occur between diverse electronic medical records. Very curious how they work with the, they call it the supplier community, they call it the vendor community, to achieve exchange of information. And I wondered if incentives were part of this, whether they played a role in all of this happening. So this is what I'm going to talk about today. First of all, for those of you who aren't as familiar with this topic, why information sharing is important to all of us, what is required for information exchange, clinical information exchange, how the UK has addressed those requirements. And the real point of all this is what the US can learn from that experience. So then we'll have time for a little discussion. So let's start out with why information sharing is important. On the surface, really, there's two reasons among many, but these I think are the most important to me, that if you don't have clinical information, and you're a practitioner, you will make decisions anyway. So absence of clinical information can cause quality and safety problems. If you're not aware someone's allergic to penicillin, and you're unconscious, you may give them penicillin by mistake. One example of that. It also has the potential to help reduce healthcare costs and to increase convenience for patients. So if you have a full picture, then there's less drive to order things that have already been ordered. And that means you, as the patient, have one less needle stick, for example, or one less radiation exposure, or one less 10-minute period telling the next person what you told the last person. So now, that's why it's important. And then you might argue, well, UK or the US are a lot different, and they are different. So let's just go over some of those differences. First of all, the UK is a lot smaller than the United States, both in population, about 60 million people, much smaller. You can see you can wrap it up if you wanted to and fit all of it in the state of Oregon. So the geography is very different. Their gross domestic product is lower than ours, somewhat proportional to the population difference. And there's another important difference. We have about 47 million people without health insurance. That's two-thirds of their entire population. So there's a comparison that isn't quite so favorable to the United States. Almost everyone in the UK has health insurance. Now, there are some exceptions. People who are there illegally don't. People who are eligible for it but don't register for it don't. And there are some other asterisk groups, but it's a very small number of people. My work visa prohibited me from getting health care from the UK. But I knew that when I went in. Now, if you aren't familiar with the UK health system, let me tell you about it very quickly. So once launched, comparing their health care system to ours. First of all, as I mentioned, all citizens have coverage through the National Health Service. It was created after World War II. It is very popular and very political. So it's a hot topic in elections, for Parliament and any other election. It is financed through taxes, and those taxes are paid through the Secretary of State for Health, comparable to we have a Secretary of Health and Human Services. They divide the nation, or the United Kingdom, into trusts. Trust is sort of a hard word to understand in this context, but what it really means is that it corresponds to a geography and a kind of care. So you have a primary care trust. That's where people go for primary care. Or a acute care trust. And those occur in a city region or county region if it's more rural. So it's divided up into a lot of these little trusts, some of them are big trusts. The primary care trusts I mentioned, the GPs who deliver the care there are not National Health Service employees. That's a misconception on the part of the United States. It's not some drag government bureaucracy with uniform practitioners. These are independent businessmen and women, and they're very aggressive in pursuing their business. They make a contract to deliver care with the National Health Service. The secondary care trusts are the hospitals and the specialists. But everything else is covered too. So ambulances, home care, and other care, such as social care. This is all part of the package. So if you leave the hospital, you have people to help you there. If things aren't going well at home with your new baby, there's support. It pretty much covers the waterfront, including pharmacy. There is tension in the UK, as there is in the US, between big government and small government and centralization and local control. The tension between the Conservative and Labour governments has led to a separate class of trusts called foundation trusts, which are, in a very brief summary, they have more financial independence. They sort of prove their ability to keep the finances of their trust in order. And so they are less, they have less connection to the national organization of NHS, but they do have some connection. So the goal is that all trusts eventually would achieve foundation status and be more autonomous than they are today. There is private care in the UK. It is limited really to elective surgery, so it represents a pretty small proportion of the care for citizens. If you wanted to have an arthroscopy or a herniorrhaphy, you might elect to have it done through a clinic that is private and outside the NHS, and some practitioners wouldn't like there. But that's a really small proportion of care. They spend less than we do. You can see on this graph for care. This is per capita. So you can notice two things. First of all, per capita, they spend a lot less than we do. And the rate at which the costs are rising is lower than it is in the United States. So they've done something differently than we have to achieve this difference in the finance of care. This is a slide that you've probably seen from Chris Murray when he was working with the World Health Organization, and it is an attempt to tie healthcare expenditure per capita to performance of the healthcare system. There are lots lots of ways you can measure performance of the healthcare system. One way is to look at life expectancy. And there are many different axes that you can use to study. But what you see here is that you can spend more, but you don't always get better return on the graph. And this is the United States out here. We are spending more than anyone per capita. Our life expectancy is lower than many places in the world. So bottom line is that increasing what you spend doesn't always get you a better return. We've got a little problem with our deficit, which everybody here is aware of. A little bit of a disagreement here between the White House and Congress. One says we have a projected deficit of $1.8 trillion. The other says, no, that's a gross exaggeration. It's only $1.75 trillion. But they both agree it's a lot, and it's projected to be worse. So this led Peter Orszag, who is our current administration White House budget director, to make the following statements in the New York Times while I was over there, that we seem to have as much as $700 billion a year in healthcare tests and services that are unnecessary, don't improve health outcomes, and just add to costs, et cetera, et cetera. There is no way you can put the nation on a sound fiscal course without bringing inefficiencies out of healthcare. So I tend to agree with him that we have a lot to accomplish. One way you can do this is to cut down on duplication, what people regard to be duplication. The president of our, this is Obama now speaking about using electronic medical records, and he thought these could help us in three ways. They will help us save money, number one. Number two, ensure privacy. Number three, save lives. So it's sort of telling how he ranked those three when he launched the Forum on Healthcare Reform. I think what he is pointing out is that until we save money, we're going to have a really hard time extending coverage too much further. So here's how I accomplished what I'm showing you this afternoon. I interviewed the 35 people you saw listed through there, and actually had several talks with people in Wales after I returned. I looked at the published literature, hence the BMJ journalist, but also, and more importantly, the unpublished literature, which people made available to me. I visited these settings of care, so went to what they call surgeries, that's what we would call a clinic. Went to hospitals, went on rounds with some of the practitioners to sort of get a feel for what it's like there. So I gathered a fair amount of information, but as those of you who have been in an epidemiology or statistics course understand, I had a very brief exposure to very complicated issues that have spanned decades, so very brief exposure. The people who spoke with me may differ from the people who I didn't have occasion to speak with and what they had to say. And even if I got it completely right, yet it's changing rapidly, so the information I present may be outdated by the time you hear it or by the time my paper reaches publication. Why do it? Because really most of the people in the United States know less about UK healthcare IT than I do. And I was in the same boat 3 months ago, 5 months ago. How many of you are familiar with Connecting for Health? So two hands. It's regarded to be the biggest healthcare IT initiative, biggest IT project in history anywhere, other than the military. So far bigger than what we have done in the United States, far bigger than the VA, Kaiser, bigger than things out of healthcare. So very, very, very big. And we really don't know much about it. So that's why I wanted to go over and and that's just the latest large national initiative. It's not the only one. There's several before that. So back to our topic, which is data exchange and interoperability. I think it'd be worth agreeing to a definition here. I'm going to show you two of them. One came from Jim Walker and others in health affairs. They broke down data exchange and interoperability into levels. And you can see there are four listed here. Non-electronic, mail, telephone, which is the way we do it a lot today. Machine transportable data, which is a fax or PDF. Machine organized data, so text, narrative text, or HL7 messages. And then machine interpretable data, which is an extension of 3 to the point where not only do you send that MSL language, but you send it in a form that the receiving system can interpret as the slightly different scale, which is shown on the right, and it shows that you have technical and syntactical interoperability. You have levels of semantic interoperability, and then you have full semantic interoperability as their third on their scale of 4.203. When you study these in detail, what Walker referred to is compressed into the upper levels here, and the real goal of both is full semantic inoperability, but that's not yet achieved in many operating systems in healthcare today. It's something everyone is shooting for. I'm referring mostly, what I'm talking about today, not to semantic interoperability, but to this level, where information is exchanged between systems in a form that a human can read and interpret, and perhaps, with some assistance, put into a machine-processable form. So that's what I'm after today. So why would that be helpful, and where would it might be used? Well, in the United Kingdom, everybody has a GP. They are completely automated. So the record, most of your record, if you don't have a chronic illness, or a serious illness, that is, that would lead you to see an oncologist or cardiologist, it is in the GP system. But you need to see, sometimes, a cardiologist or a rheumatologist or both. You may visit another city. You may go to a different GP in the same city. You may want to see it yourself. The pharmacy needs to know a little bit about your care. So do all these other sides of it. So there are lots of occasions when your information would be helpful outside of the GP surgery where you get your primary care. And these arrows are really what I'm after here. The density of the arrow here really is a subjective judge of how often each of these kinds of exchange occur. So as far as saving money, there are two recent studies on this. They conflict a little bit on how much could be achieved. But remember those 1, 2, 3, 4 levels from the Walker study? This is the analysis results for how much money could be saved at 2, 3, and 4. And the net value of full information exchange, which is the extreme that we haven't achieved, but the potential, they estimate to be about $77 billion a year, which, you know, Peter R. Salk says $700 million. You know, this is getting there. It's helpful. I said, yes, in billions. So it's a lot of money. Compared to what we spend, it's not that much. But there is at least the hope that we can save a lot. Now, there's another study that says, you know what, this is optimistic. Probably not going to happen at once. Probably won't be perfect. And that's all valid criticism, I think. But on the other hand, it doesn't consider that if you send somebody into the hospital for an evaluation and the evaluation was actually performed somewhere else, that whole hospitalization might be unnecessary, or a trip to a consultant. So it's really hard to know where this figure is. I guess the bottom line is it's probably a lot of money that you could save if you exchange information seamlessly. And how does it work today? I know that some of you are practitioners, some of you are not. We do have information exchange in a number of places today, between clinics and hospitals. Within the VA, there's a very good model for information exchange. Some HMOs, like Kaiser, patients see their own information on a large scale, and the biggest example in the United States would be Kaiser. There's interest in commercial systems such as HealthVault and Google Health. So it's actually happening. However, most clinics, and this is the VA's, by the way, picture of the VA, you can't really tell, but this is the record in the VA, and you've got this little drop down that shows 4 other VAs where information is available. You can quickly access it to look at it. But usually information comes in this sort of a form, that the record is physically transported with you, or it comes through the mail, and these are taken from my clinic at Roosevelt. So this is the way it works in the United States. Very little information exchange between Virginia Mason and UW. This is from Virginia Mason. It's for a patient that we share. And that's really how it works today in most places. So let's say you want to improve on that. What requirements would you list for larger scale clinical information exchange? Well, this is the model I came up with, which I think is a good starting point. First of all, you have to have a legal and ethical environment for information exchange. You have to have consent. You have to have agreement that if it's an emergency, maybe consent isn't necessary under circumstances, and you've got to be comfortable doing this on a legal point of view. You also have to have a secure medium for exchange. You're not going to put all of your information on Facebook, most likely, most people won't. And you want to make sure that people who you don't want to see a record don't see it. You also need to have some incentives for information exchange to exist. And those incentives must exist both for the person sending the information and for the recipient. Example of this would be, if I am a neurologist here, and you are sent from another hospital here for headaches, and you had an MRI a week ago, and I'm seeing you in clinic today, and I don't have your MRI. So I can spend time to get that MRI result, or I can order a new one. Now, MRIs don't involve radiation exposure. Turns out the hospital makes money when we order MRIs, and the radiologist gets a professional fee. So it's a hassle for me to get that MRI in many cases, and yet my hospital and my colleagues profit from it. Now, we don't talk about this openly very often, but it's true that there isn't a very strong incentive for us to exchange information. And that's just one example, but you have to think about this, what's going to make people work on these problems. And recipient, if you do exchange information, has to be able to do something with an electronic form. Otherwise, why bother sending an electronic form? And the information that you want has to be in electronic form to start with. Otherwise, it's very difficult to send electronically if it's a paper chart. So that's the framework, and I put it into three layers. I'll refer to these layers as we go through this talk. The first is sort of foundations. And the next is incentives, and the third is the applications that both the sender and the receiver use. In the foundations, I'm referring to things such as infrastructure, a system of care and policy. Incentives, I mean financial incentives, clinical incentives, and I'll mention the last one is reputational incentives. The third layer is the applications, and the UK has a lot of applications. I show a few here that are enabled, as it were, for information exchange through the UK. And if you have all this in place, you have clinical information exchange. So how did the UK do all this? Let's start with the foundations. They, in this quick slide, I'll just show you some of the things that they've done. They have a National Health Service number. They use strong authentication. They have NHSNet. They've got application standards that are used for all, not all, but most of the vendor systems there. The code records, they have unique numbers for the practitioners, facilities, and practices. They've been working at this for decades. In the policy arena, they've had a very public, somewhat painful discussion of the pros and cons of privacy of all of this. They've developed policies and groups that help with these policies. They have frameworks of care that help everyone sort of play by the same general playbook for evaluating somebody with a problem, helps know what information you should exchange. And they also have a GP who coordinates care for the citizens. So you in the UK, you know who your GP is. The Prime Minister knows who his or her GP is. And they have civil care. So these are sort of foundational elements. I'm going to talk about a few of these in more detail. First of all, the authentication, the strong authentication I mentioned. There's a book called For the Record that was one of the first Institute of Medicine books on healthcare, IT and EMR. So everybody knows about Two Errors Human and Crossing the Paul Lilly Chasm. Fewer people know about the first book in that series, which is called For the Record, and it was on protecting electronic health information, privacy and security. And in that book is a section on authentication, and they talk about the value of basing it on something you have, something you know, and something related to where you are. So the term strong authentication means having more than one of these. They don't actually define strong authentication, but they use it in a way that I infer means you have more than one. What we do here at UW Medicine is we have a username and a password, actually many of those. But So in the NHS, they have a username and password, and they also have a badge. And you can see here that this badge is plugged into the keyboard of systems used in the National Health Service. So they follow the something you have, something you know recommendation. The combination of those two is better. That's how you get money from your cash machine. You have a card and a PIN. But that's not how we get information from electronic health records. It also builds confidence that you are who you say you are, so that information can be exchanged to you when you ask for it. It is being implemented. In fact, when I visited these practices, everybody I saw had this card. You can see on the card is a little chip. And so it's not just the number, which I faked here, but it's the chip. So it's a physical card. And there are places around the country that have this. Nowhere near the scale of it in the UK, which is a national card. It's a smart card. And this is a picture of Mike Bainbridge, who is an amazing person, extremely bright person who has been working on many of these projects. And I took this in his home, he pulled it out, and showed me. That's the first time I heard about these cards. Anybody else heard of these smart cards that are in the UK? Yeah. So that's helpful. NHS number. That is a way to link Mrs. Jones from one city to the next. It has roots in the Registrar for Marriages, Births, and Deaths, which was assigned to citizens when they were born, within 42 days of birth. From the 1950s on, it evolved, and it has been extremely helpful to the exchange of information, because we have now a way to be sure with a level of certainty that's sufficient for clinical purposes, that we know we're talking about the same person. In most hospitals that I view, they have their own identifier they use internally, because that's been there for a long time. But when they exchange information outside of their hospital, they use an NHS number, and they publicize this. When they go to conferences, you'll see NHS slides, and in the, you know, the little bond thing here, they might say, use the NHS number. So they're trying to push it out. It comes as I said, from birth certificates. This is a picture of a birth certificate, which was publicly available, so I can show it to you. It's John Lennon's birth certificate. And that is the place where the NHS number started, was in birth certificates. They revised the system so that it no longer takes 42 days, because as some of you in the audience know, a lot of things can happen to a child before they reach 42 days of life. So now they have one that goes back to birth. The spine is a very interesting structure in their healthcare IT organization, and we don't really have an analogous structure here. It has changed since the project started, the Connecting for Health started, but today it is a combination of national infrastructure, a set of transactions, and applications that use those transactions for exchange of information across the country. So the applications would include Choosing Book, I'll tell you more about that, Patient Demographics, Service Summary Care Record, GP to GP, and the Electronic Prescription Service, EPS. And there's two versions of EPS. It is, it underlies, and it's really the core of what is behind information exchange in the UK. So when we talk about this, we mention a national health information network, too, in our United States discussion of healthcare IT. We talk about it a fair amount. However, it doesn't seem to have quite the prominence that it did in the UK. For all of its limitations, the Connecting for Health project was launched with, six pillars. One pillar for each of the five regions of the UK. And the sixth pillar, equal in size in their diagrams, was the spine. So the spine was a very prominent part of their vision for healthcare IT for the United Kingdom. And I think for good reason. So now I mentioned policy. There has been a lot in the press about privacy and confidentiality, a very heated discussion. One example of this was a case that was highly publicized of a child who unfortunately turned out to have been physically abused. And the child was taken to a variety of after-hours clinics for care. But no single practitioner had the whole view of that child's history. So they didn't put two and two together. And this led to public discussion of how wouldn't it be better if we could see the other parts of the story and understand the pattern that might protect children like this? That was one. The other end of the spectrum is that from time to time a USB drive is found on a subway that contains identified health information and has NHS written on it, and that is a very, very bad thing. And so the press has sold a lot of newspapers with stories of both kinds. So in reaction to this, there have been a variety of national boards formed and inquiries launched. Dame Caldicott had one of these, and it was very highly regarded. They formed an entity called Caldicott Guardians. Anybody know about this? I've asked our privacy officer, they never heard of it. Somebody does. Are you from the UK or? Okay, so somebody from the UK has heard of it, but I've never heard of this. It is a very interesting structure, and it is somebody who works in a hospital like ours, who has sort of the conscience of the organization. Not the Richard Meeks, you know, privacy officer. It is somebody who is maybe a practitioner, maybe an administrator, but is specially trained and has ongoing education to understand the circumstances in which information can be appropriately and ethically exchanged. So they are called on to help in judgments that come up in day-to-day process of care. Very interesting structure. They also have a national board called the National Information Governance Board that meets monthly, and I got to join them for one of their meetings. And they are the ones that struggle with tough questions about health information exchange and privacy. An example of this is, summary care record is a subset of your GP record that would, in certain circumstances, be available to someone treating you after hours or in an emergency. Not your own GP, but somebody else. And the question is, in an adult, you have to tell the National Health Service that you don't want one. It's called opt-out. They don't create one for you. They create one for everybody, unless you say, I don't want one. And then when you are in the emergency room and someone needs to actually use it, they have to get your permission, and they're going to do it, unless they declare an emergency, in which case they can do it. Now, that means that you have the option to opt-out. What if you're 2 years old? You can't opt-out. You're not old enough to understand this. So should they create a summary care record for you at age 2 or not? And that's the sort of issue that isn't clear-cut, and this group is called on to help decide that. And sometimes they ask Parliament to take this up. Sometimes they issue a policy, it's a multidisciplinary group. It includes the public, it includes practitioners like pediatricians, lawyers, observers from professional organizations. It's quite a crowd, and this was a very animated discussion. I was introduced as a visitor, and very interesting day with humor, but also some pretty tense moments. So it's an interesting structure that is part of the national policy infrastructure for information exchange. I mentioned the frameworks. The frameworks are, it's an idea that what do you do for somebody with heart failure? You gather this information, you follow this general algorithm, and it's quite detailed. And the value of that to information exchange is, if you are sending a person from one practitioner to another, say to a consultant, you know, you certainly want to gather the information framework to send along. And it helps you remember to help that patient be prepared for the visit. So the frameworks enter into this because they sort of let us know what, out of everything in that GP record, what is it that's most valuable for that visit. I mentioned the National Information Governance Board. So now let's move to incentives, which to me was the most interesting part of this. Incentives are, we've got a listing here of them quickly, and I'll just go through this one in detail, but suffice to say that if you're in a hospital and you don't get discharge letters within 48 hours to the GP, then the next year you pay a penalty. Now, I don't know how many of you work in medical records here or have, but we're not quite up to that standard. In fact, we're lucky if we have it dictated within 48 hours or written, let alone signed, let alone mailed, let alone know who the GP is that we send it to. But 48 hours is the bar there, and it's going down to 24 hours. So you can do that through fax, through mail, through whatever you want. But if it's 24 hours, electronic is probably the way to go, because otherwise it's a lot harder to get it done. So that's a very strong incentive for consultants and acute trusts. Salary is linked to the quality outcome framework. Between 20 and 50% of a GP's salary is tied to their score on the quality outcomes framework. They have a very strong incentive to get high scores on these tests, and that high score depends on automated data. So if your patient moves to your practice from somewhere else, and you have to type it in or ask your office staff to type it in, that's a cost you bear. Therefore, they put a lot of pressure on vendors and the government to require these data to be exchanged, and that's how GP to GP came into existence. It also makes you practice better medicine if you have a good complete record. This incentive system is the most interesting of all to me. GP systems of choice and the common assurance process, they're based on the agreement that as a GP, you can buy any system you want as long as it is on the list of systems of choice and it follows certain agreements. Now, actually, you can buy any system you want whether or not it does that. However, if you buy one that is in that system of choice list, the National Health Service will pay you back. Now, not all the way. There's no free lunch here. They don't pay everything. You still have to buy your laser jet toner and the paper for your printer. But everything else, the hardware, the software, licensing, that is reimbursed by the National Health Service if you select one of these systems that meets these standards. So that's an extremely strong incentive. We're talking about $44K per practice lump sum through our current debate in the United States. This has been going on for, well, this is RFA 99, that's 1999. So suppliers, i.e. vendors, have a very strong incentive to follow RFA 99, because if they don't follow it, then if a GP practitioner buys their system, they will not be reimbursed by the NHS. So that's a sort of a no-brainer. They will conform to it. So that's an example of a very strong incentive to make this work. We know financial incentives work. We have great examples. My own day is influenced by Medicare and Medicaid services, requiring us to follow professional and facility fee billing requirements, and we follow them as the best we can. In the VA, they try to improve quality. They tie 10% of the visit director's salary to their performance on these, and not too surprising, the VA improved in this. So financial incentives have a long history in our country, too. They haven't been applied to this to the degree that they were in the UK. So GP system of choice with the contract framework, RFA 99B1.1, I have that on my laptop. I've got a copy of it, sort of like the Magna Carta of standards in healthcare IT. And then it's now, the most modern phrase they use for this is common assurance process for GP systems. This is what it looks like, and I just took some screen prints here. You can see that message information exchange is part of this standard. You go down here to the areas that are addressed, electronic data exchange. And then you look at requirements for accreditation, and I'll blow it up for those in the back. Mandatory and optional requirements in the field of electronic data exchange. So it's spelled out in the regulations from the Department of Health. They say, under existing regulations, practices are entitled to choose from and be reimbursed for RFA 99B1.1042 compliant systems. Systems that do not comply with RFA 99 should not be eligible for reimbursement. So it's open and everybody understands the rules of the game. And this is a reminder, in 2003, and this was updated in 2007. So we're going on a lot. I told you about the salary. It really changes your experience in a GP office. There's a good side to this that is the nation picks this quality outcome framework and they incent providers to follow it. The bad news is it influences how your experience is and with your GP, because the GP is going to be checking on your immunizations, checking your feet if you have diabetes, making sure you're up to date on your cholesterol screening, whatever else is within the framework that applies to you. But that may mean that some things you actually want them to address are not addressed as heavily. So it's a double-edged sword. There's no miraculous solution to how to ideally deliver care. But this really works. People pay attention to the quality and outcomes framework. The other incentive for this is not financial. It was sort of the clinical scenario that in the latest contract between GPs and the National Health Service, they do this, I'm not sure it's annually, but it's periodically. They have a master contract that you then use as the basis for your contract between your practice and the NHS. Out-of-hours care is now not required by the GP. So they take care of a panel of patients. But if it's 2 in the morning, someone else can check their belly if they have a bowel. So now somebody else is in the involvement care. They need to know what's going on. So there's a strong incentive there, a clinical reason, that we wanted information on that, from that GP system. So finally, applications. And there's a long list. My favorites are the fact that GP care is automated almost everywhere, and GP-to-GP that I'll tell you about in a second. But there's lots of other systems here, PACS, regional repositories, NHSML. This is a fascinating system that is used for electronic prescriptions throughout the UK. They have their own, what we would refer to as a personal health record, a little bit problematic, quite problematic. Radiology and pathology messaging, discharge letter messaging, a lot from here, but let's talk about just two of them. The first is EMR use in general practices. They've been doing this for about 15 years. It's not new. It is vast majority of practices have them. Almost all prescriptions are entered electronically. About 1 million prescriptions a day are entered electronically. GPs control the pharmacy budget, basically. The specialists can give a short supply when they leave the hospital. The GPs are the ones that manage the medications. The notes of the GP officer are a mixture of encoded and narrative text. They have pathology, which is their term for what we call anatomic pathology, and chemistries are via interfaces. And the average GP that I spoke with, which again could be a biased sample, very informatics savvy. They will be able to tell you strengths and weaknesses of SNOMED CT, of READ, of all the versions of READ. That is their practice. They understand how these systems work. And there you see a GP in economically deprived section of Manchester. And he's actually dictating a letter. And the letter is going to go to a consultant. He's giving a narrative text portion of the consultant letter. And it would be sent with the referral when he pushes the button. GP to GP, that's general practice to general practice. It transfers encoded in narrative text portion of the electronic record from one commercial GP system to another. So this would be analogous not only doing Epic to Epic in our world, or Cerner to Cerner, which in our community is starting but is not very far along, but from Epic to Cerner. And that isn't very far along at all. I mean, there's lots of ways people want to do it, but it's not very common. And what about Epic to GE, GE to Cerner, all these together? In the UK, these records are transferred from all the different systems to one to another. It's used at the moment for about 1/6 of the occasions when a UK citizen moves from one GP to another. It happens about 3 million times a year, and 500,000 of those, or 1/6, have their record transferred electronically. And more, the curve is positive, it's going up. So it works between and within vendors. The main driver for this, as I mentioned, was the cost of manual extraction and data entry, which had previously been borne by the GP staff, and they need this encoded data to score well on the cloth. So that was the driver. But once you have the data, you can use it for lots of purposes. I see you had your pneumovax, but it's now October. You need your flu shot. You can get that in Liverpool. We'll give it to you today. That sort of thing. It's possible. So this will be in the paper, but it's a big table that shows all of these different systems that I mentioned and where these different pieces of the incentives and the foundation fit in and where they seem to be working really well. So the PAC system. I didn't talk about national PAC system, regional repositories, very popular. And all of these things rely on the NHS number, except for maybe NHS mail, which is between practitioners usually. Smart cards are used for patient exchange and so on. So these are all these things. You reach a level where they all interact with each other, and it's hard to tease them apart. So just to show you where we are at the time I left the UK, GP to GP, I mentioned 1/6 of all transfers, choosing book, electronic scheduling for consultant visits, 15 million bookings, about 33,000 a day, 127 PACS systems and 27 trusts, so this is pretty much all over the place. It's been extremely popular. And it's the same GE PAC system that we use here. Same one. I looked at it and I knew how to run it, and someone showed it to me. But it's national. Discharge letters we talked about. Summary care record I mentioned briefly. It relies on the spine. EPS-1. This area, all the prescriptions are electronic, but about 78% are now communicating that record with a piece of paper that serves as a key for the prescription. So you actually get a piece of paper when you leave the GP office. You take that to the pharmacist, they scan it, and that brings the pharmacy information down from the central post, so they don't have to read your handwriting. It isn't handwritten, it's electronic. So it's a much better system than my prescriptions. NHS mail web access, this is all in production. There are other models for clinical information exchange, as you all know here. I guess the most interesting and appealing to many people is that you get the healthcare organization out of the business of being the custodian of care and put it in the hands of the person to whom it makes the greatest difference, which is the patient. And that is being explored too. It's not broad in the UK, it's really not broad yet here, but it wouldn't rely on a lot of the things I've been showing you here today. And I think it's complementary, it doesn't necessarily compete with what I've been describing. So today, the graph I showed you is carried out in using the application shown here. It's actually happening. This is not all a recent thing. The National Program for Information Technology, NPFIT, which is embodied with Connecting for Health Project, $23 billion with a B. 6 years ago, it was launched for a country a fifth our size. So prorate that to the United States, that would be over $100 billion 6 or 7 years ago. A big investment on the part of the country. It has not gone uniformly well. There's been some very, very fundamental errors made and lots of troubles. That's the latest one, the one that gets in the press, third incarnation of the network. There's lots within it that actually has gone very, very well that you don't read about in the tabloids and that isn't described on the floor of Parliament. Before that, Information Authority. Before that, Information Management Group. So there are lots of these projects were underway long ago. And it is tied to the government in power, so there's sort of political layer to this, which is, I think, inevitable when you have a political system like the NHS. But the point of this slide really is that this has been going on a long time, and I would guess it's going to continue going on even when the conservatives come into power. So my observations, they have a great foundation and some applications in place. It's real, it's happening. Not all these are available nationally. They're not all long-standing. Some of them are very recent. There is potential for much larger scale information exchange. This could really take off. The information to and from hospitals and consultative care is not as big a part of information exchange as within the GP world. That is a weakness of the UK system in inpatient care. The early analysis of one little piece of this, which is the PAC system analysis from Chodo Gremlin, not yet published, showed a 55% reduction in repeat x-rays attributable to the PACs. That was the example I was giving you about the headache and the MRI. 55% reduction. So it's probably going to be beneficial to them from a financial point of view as well. So here are my questions and the answers I got. How have they, what barriers to help improve information exchange have been addressed in the UK? They've done this with policy, infrastructure, systems, and applications, and with a strong use of incentives. What barriers remain and why? Much of the acute care, i.e. hospital care, remains on paper, Hospital workflows have not changed as much as primary care. Primary care leads in this arena, big time. Has the UK succeeded in bringing myriad health information technologies together? And I would say they have partially succeeded in doing this by setting up a national framework, setting up standards, setting up the spine, and setting up strong incentives to participate. And the suppliers are then faced with a choice of complying or not. Most of them choose to comply, not all of them. Some of them go out of business or go to elsewhere in the globe. And the use of suppliers is evolving. That is, more and more, there's more diversity than there used to be on the number of suppliers, and they will conform to these rules. The incentives have been very powerful here. They're for financial, clinical, and reputational incentives, and they have been aligned more completely than they are here. So in summary, they've made a lot of progress in this arena. The features that were most impressive to me were the RFA, the requirements for accreditation I mentioned to you, the GP systems of choice, the national infrastructure, including the spine, the broad use of EMRs in primary care, and the scope of this initiative. It's really breathtaking how broad this is in their nation. There is some early evidence that clinical information exchange has reduced costs, but I think the real benefits are ahead of them, and I think patient involvement is probably going to grow from what it is today. They have had a very difficult course. It's been very open, very public, and it's also been incredibly creative. And non-event of here syndrome is at work here. We don't know as much about it as we probably should, and I'll point to myself first. I think we and our policymakers should learn from this experience. So one person said, Tom, you know, they all know easy answers to this. It's very difficult. But I would say yes, but it's probably a little easier for all of us if we learn from each other. So I will close with some thanks to my family who let me go over there for 2 months, came to visit, and to Ian Buchan, who is just a terrific individual, and to the people on his team who literally put a roof over my head, the team that I work with there, and the patients and colleagues here who sort of gave me leave to leave for 2 months, and we have time for some questions and discussion for those of you who know more about it.
So you spoke about the sort of quality guidelines against which physicians are held and they get paid. You said checking the meter, I mean.
Right.
How is that set up, and I guess the question is how do they slant that to make sure that incentivizes towards care for the patient, not incentivizing some other direction?
So a good way to find out and answer your question would just be to Google quality and outcomes framework. NHS space quality outcomes framework, and it will describe the process used to create this. It's very detailed. It involves the British Medical Association, which is basically the union for the GPs, and other professional societies, and the NHS, of course. So it is, it's kind of like we have US Preventive Services Task Force, we have AHRQ, we have lots of groups that put together this, we have Medicare. But this is sort of all that into one agreed upon standard. And it is as much as possible scientifically based, but as you all know, science takes it so far, and then it's mostly judgment picks up after that. So, complicated process, they do their best, it's very open, and the details would be available from the Department of Health.
We probably have time for one more question. I can hear people trying to come in. So the one comment I'd make is that there's the difference is it is a societal population perspective rather than an individual perspective. That is the fundamental difference. So the alignment is not what benefits each patient maximally in the room, but what benefits the population.
Which leads to the verb to be quaffed. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is exactly what Peter said.
I mean, you know, it's a societal decision. Basically, we want all diabetics to have good control, and we are willing to allow the 0.0001% of people with genetic diseases to not necessarily get every single intervention they would in other countries that have different alignments.
Yeah.
So it's definitely an enormous trade-off. It means they're willing to accept that some people are going to slip through the cracks for the sake of greater efficiency and greater population benefit. And it's just a very different societal alignment.
Less.